Good morning. Oh, come on.
Good morning.
Haven't had enough coffee. Well, there's more coffee upstairs. I hope you're here to learn about Safe Church and the Safe Church program. My name is Carl Bachman. I'm the executive director of Samaritan Counseling Center. And this is... And hopefully, by the end of this segment, you'll know a lot more about Safe Church, what the program is, how it operates, as well as we're going to hit some of the highlights around the new law and what it means to be a mandated reporter these days in the church. Let's start by just kind we would be interested in finding out what you want from this. Because Michelle and I have done this numerous times. And so we want to make sure we're giving you the information that you're looking for. Something made you choose this. Maybe this, the other four just looked like awful. But something made you choose this one. Poppy? Okay.
I know that it's a Sioux culture, and also there are some true dangers, but there's also some just perceived dangers.
Okay.
To understanding both of those things without becoming sort of hypochondriacs with that every person is a predator, but also being aware that there are people who should not be in certain situations.
Right. Okay. Other things you, yes?
I'm actually new to the Pittsburgh area, seminarian as well, so I came to learn more about, Pittsburgh state laws,
okay.
Reporting,
okay.
And what the resources are in the area for
okay.
Education.
Okay. Yes?
I'm an LPC and worked in the child and adolescent department at WPIC for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
So I'm familiar with, being a professional, being a reporter, and reported lots of things, unfortunately. And so now I'm the director of pastoral care at Amplify Church in the city.
Hmm.
And I just want to make sure that all of our volunteers are, knowing what their responsibilities are.
Right.
And as a, coming from a professional to talking to people who are brand new to volunteering.
Okay.
So
okay.
I want to make sure we know what we need to do.
Okay. Okay. Yes.
I'm with the Episcopal Diocese of Pittsburgh, and we're in the process. We have folks who have attended some prior presentations of how the task force. We're in the process of trying to roll out sort of recommended ways forward with the new laws, which are pretty overwhelming, especially
mm-hmm.
for very small parishes,
overwhelming mm-hmm.
both in terms of process and finances. So I guess in my mind, I'm interested to hear your presentation and also think about how do we invest the resources we have most wisely to protect our children.
Okay.
There's an awful lot of things, you can do. And we just, I think we have to sort of pick where to
right,
start.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, that sounds like I appreciate you sharing all those. And it looks like those are the kind of things that we can help you with during this time. So we would like this to be a discussion. So if there are questions, comments, as we go along, please feel free to interrupt. There will be a time at the end for Q&A, but feel free to interrupt at the time. Safe Church is a program developed out of the Samaritan Counseling Center in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It was developed specifically for that area, and they found out that it was such a good program that the Ms. Foundation came in and funded it, and now it is a national program in all of the major cities in the United States, Chicago, Seattle, down into Texas, up into New York. So that's where it is. comes from the biblical mandate, no longer will violence be hurting your land nor ruin and destruction within your borders. You will call your walls salvation and your gates praise. Let me just interrupt. Can you all see the slides? Is the light? Which would you prefer?
I like that.
It's better.
You like this better?
Yeah.
Okay. It just looked washed out to me to see it that way. So the biblical mandate is this, and I think we would all agree that right now there is not a lot of praise and salvation in our land right now. Just watching the news this week, I don't know how many different segments of the news had to deal with children being abused in the school. One story about a child being abused in a church just this week on the news. There's a lot of it out there. A safe church environment is one that provides for the protection of the physical, emotional, and spiritual health and well-being of each person, not just the children. The children are more at risk, but we're really trying to develop a safe kind of sanctuary, wholeness, healing atmosphere within the churches. Why focus on childhood sexual abuse? One in four girls, one in six boys are sexually abused by age 18. Just for a moment, let that kind of sink in and think what that means in the churches where you're leading worship or where you worship, excuse me, on a Sunday morning. If you think about that, any Sunday morning, 18 to 20% of the people in your church have been or are being sexually abused. And so it is not just a small segment. It is not something that's just affecting a few people. This is a major thing that impacts people's lives. Yes?
Do you mean in the church environment or in the whole environment?
The one in four and the one in six are national. So that's not within the church,
okay. But
the church statistics are in there. If you, for sure, the Catholics and their background in getting kind of outed are definitely up there, but it's not just the Catholics. It is not just the Catholics.
Carl, can I say, I think that when we talk about, say, church, there's two things we're talking about. We're talking about there are kids in our church who are being in our churches. And then there are people in our churches who have been abused, right? So this number, I think, speaks to the fact that in a congregation, one in four and one in six have been abused, not necessarily in our walls, but that is the demographic we're preaching to and teaching to.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
Right. Maya Angelou, who was herself a victim of childhood sexual abuse, said that sexual abuse can take a child who knows nothing and turn her into a child who believes nothing. That's an important statement when you think about churches and what churches are trying to do. Churches are trying to establish a foundation for children to believe in something, and childhood sexual abuse can just eliminate that. One of the big questions that victims, survivors of childhood sexual abuse will almost always ask is, where was God? Why didn't God prevent this? Why me? Why was I selected? And so it really lays the foundation for a child to have a sense that they are not loved, cared for, and it's hard for them to feel loved and cared for by God, hence this quote. The core aspects of Safe Church is that we try to integrate childhood sexual abuse prevention and ways that we can respond in congregations from a theological as well as a spiritual commitment both within the church and the community. To educate and empower parents so that children and other congregants will be able to prevent childhood sexual abuse and to lift up and empower the adult survivors in the congregation who have been sexually abused at some point in their history. Safe Church involves these six major features: the development of a policy of best practices, and that's what churches are really being pushed to do because of the new state law. The new state law has a lot of factors to it, and it pays for the church to have a written policy so that the church can address whatever comes up proactively rather than waiting until it comes up and then say, what should we do? We train volunteers and staff. We educate parents and congregants. We honor the survivors and help them either start their healing or continue it. We utilize the resources for congregational awareness through educational events, through an all-day retreat for survivors, and there's also a curriculum for children and teens. No matter what our theological orientation, and in a setting like this, in a gathering like this, theologically, we're probably all over the spectrum. But I think regardless of where we're at theologically, we can all agree that protecting our children is a priority. Do you know this lady? Do you have her in your church? That's the sense of, well, let me back up. What I talked about was what Safe Church is and what it does, and Michelle's going to take over and talk about some of the implications of the law and how Safe Church can complement that.
Yeah, good question. So I guess the answer is yes. There has been sweeping legislation across Pennsylvania, right? And I think there's been a lot of frenzy among church leaders about what they don't know that they don't know about the change in the legislation. Prior to the change in the legislation, our colleague in Lancaster put together the Safe Church program because she believed that this was an issue that mattered as the whole Catholic Church sex scandal was coming down and all of those things. We feel strongly, I think I can use the we, that one of the risks of the legislation, so the legislation happened in order to sort of force churches to do a better job, right? So we're going to talk, like I'm going to talk now about clearances. I'm going to talk about mandated reporting. I'm going to talk about the changes in the law. But what it does is give churches, kind of lulls churches into this sense that we need to do these things and then we're okay, right? It generates questions from the room like, do we have to get this person cleared? Or can we get away with not getting this person cleared? What do we do about VBS? Do we have to, right? The Safe Church program and process that we have created, that Linda has created, that we're implementing, is one that says Safe Church is about way more than clearances. In fact, clearances are a very low bar when it comes to protecting children. In fact, what we need is a whole culture change. We need to change the way we think about Safe Church. We need to change the way that we imagine what we get to do in order to become, right, communities of hope and safety and restoration. So when I'm done talking, Carl's going to talk again about, like, PPI and Samaritan Counseling Center are doing a Safe Church program that will start in July, where we invite churches to participate in this process, which is some of what he just talked about. That's a year-long process of working with congregations to develop their own policy, to change their own culture. That's a bottom-up and organic kind of process, and it's a facilitated process. So, yes, that is the Safe Church process. But there have been changes to the law. I think probably in Pennsylvania it's ground zero because this is where Jerry Sandusky happened, and it was the Sandusky case that pushed these changes through the legislature. And so we've got probably some of the most intense child protection laws in the country at this point. The reason churches are panicking is at least in part because of this lady, right? Does everybody have this lady in their church? Uh-huh. Yep, the one who has taught Sunday school for 40 years and who, has no idea why you're making her do this. So, church employees have been mandated reporters for a very long time. We do this presentation regionally a ton. Could do this in my sleep. I think we run into people who didn't know that they, church employees who didn't know that they were supposed to get cleared and who were mandated reporters. But the reality is that they have been mandated reporters for a long time. That hasn't changed. What has changed is that now volunteers are being required to have clearances and to be mandated reporters. So this slide says it would be presumptuous for us in the church to assert that we are immune to this kind of sin. Like all people, we have places of brokenness within us. If I've done this presentation 25 times, I've had somebody raise their hand and rail against government influence in the work and life of the church. The reality is that if the church was doing what they should have been doing, what blew up in the Catholic Church wouldn't have happened. And so the government felt the need to step in. And the reality is that we have blind spots. And so that's true. Instead of viewing the screening process as a necessary evil, we see it as an opportunity to promote teamwork and demonstrate mutual submission. And so this is a real opportunity. When everybody's panicked, this is the time to have these questions. This is the time to say, what do we get to do in order to support and care for children? So, the law. This is the new definition of a mandated reporter. And this is a particular definition, and this is a complicated definition. And so I am going to read you this definition and walk you through it. The PA Child Protection Services Law, which is what CPSL stands for, imposes a reporting mandate or requirement on any adult who comes into contact with children in the course of his or her work or professional practice. Let's stop there. So that tells us who in your building that is an employee is a mandated reporter. And that is anyone who comes into contact with children in the course of his or her work or professional practice. That means just about any employee you have who comes into contact with children, right? Are there any questions that part of the definition raises for you? Yeah, please.
But if I think about if we have a financial secretary who works hours when there's no children's program at the church.
Right.
But you know, on occasion, some kid might come to the church during the day. I mean, it seems to me that that's a different category of employee than, for example, a sexton who's opening the building or cleaning after there's a group there. And this is already very long. I'm just wondering if as the implementation of this has unfolded, if there's becoming any kind of nuances about frequency of interaction or not yet at this point.
I have not heard any clarification about frequency of interaction, but I think that is the nuance of it, right? That is the nuance, because what does it mean to come in contact with children? With what frequency? Right. I would be inclined to say that the financial secretary is not a mandated reporter.
It certainly seemed like that would not be the first priority. It would certainly, in our view, it wouldn't be the first. If we have to carve this into something
right.
That would be the first.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think the custodian that works midnight shift is not a mandated reporter. But correct, would be, right? So that in itself is nuanced. Second part of the definition. or an individual, paid or unpaid, who on the basis of the individual's role as an integral part of a regularly scheduled program, activity, or service, accepts responsibility for a child. That's a pretty different definition, right? For the person who wanted to know about volunteers. Who are the volunteers that are mandated reporters? That is a little bit different. Did you have a question? Okay, so we're not actually talking about clearances here. We're talking about mandated reporting. We'll talk about clearances in a second. But as a mandated reporter, I think the question there would be, who is accepting responsibility of the child? If the parent is present, is somebody accepting responsibility of the child? Maybe or maybe not. And I am not particularly inclined to answer that question for people. I'm particularly inclined to help people think it through for themselves. Because I'm not sure that you couldn't make a case for one or the other. But you need to know what you're making a case for. You need to know that when I read the law says this, I read that to mean this, and therefore we did these best practices based on our best understanding, right? So one of the questions we get is about VBS. Do you have to, are mandated reporters for VBS? I think that's a little more gray than Carl does, which is probably right in, you know, the, sort of the nuance of this is built right into our team. I think Carl would say
they're mandated
reporters because VBS is a regularly scheduled activity that happens annually. I think I might say, because it happens annually, I don't know that it's a regularly scheduled activity. I think best practice is that they mandated, that they report. But I think a case could be made, unless it's on the same weekend every August. So that's the definition for volunteers who are mandated reporters. Mm-hmm. Volunteers accept responsibility. So do the kitchen workers at VBS are they mandated reporters? Well, it depends on whether the kids are sent to the dining room by themselves or whether the teacher brings them. Yep. And this is where you begin to get into the value of having very clear guidelines that are very clear policies about how we understand and who we understand, right? We did one of these not that long ago where somebody said, well, kids come to church on Sunday morning and their parents drop them off and they all come in and they just eat breakfast. And there are people that work behind the table, but nobody's really in charge. To which we say, then everybody is in charge. Right? If nobody's in charge, then everybody there has accepted responsibility for the children. If you designate that there is a lead teacher who is accepting responsibility, then now you've designated that by policy, that is the person who's the mandated reporter. So your policy begins to matter a lot in how you think this through. So this is the mandated reporting law. In PA, anyone under the age of 18 is defined as a child for mandated reporting purposes. So if you have a 6'5", 250-pound, 17-year-old football player in your church who's getting in fistfights with his father, that's reportable because he is 17 years old. He's bigger than me, but he's still a child according to the law. If anyone 18 or older discloses abuse as a child, mandated reporting does not apply. So if that kid, 3 days after his 18th birthday, says, "My dad beat me up last week," that doesn't need to be reported. And that's particular, but there's the particularity of the law, 18 and older, 18 and under. Anyone age 18 or older is defined as an adult for mandated reporting purposes. So that same kid, 18 years and 3 days old, if they are a volunteer in the after-school program, is now mandated to report if they see something. And those under age 18 are not considered mandated reporters. So the 16-year-old babysitter is not a mandated reporter. And to say they're not a mandated reporter doesn't mean they can't report. It means that they are not mandated by the law to report. Yes?
What about people over 18 with developmental disabilities or in some particularly, you know, that maybe not functioning on an adult level? Is there nothing in there at this point about that?
I have heard nothing.
In terms of them
being mandated reporters.
So whether you're mentally 18 or not, it doesn't matter. It's just the chronological age.
Right. If they have developmental disabilities, I would question whether they should be charged and be back to the earlier side.
Yeah.
Whether they would be responsible for the child.
I was thinking that person be a victim as opposed to being a victim.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
I think there are other laws that I am less familiar with about care for the disabled and the aging.
This is about mandated reporters.
Yeah, yeah. Yes?
I would just ask, okay, so a 16, 17-year-old paid person would be a mandated reporter?
No.
Just because they're under 18, they don't have to report. Even if they're being paid to accept the responsibility, like a nursery worker or
according to the law, it's pretty black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So to be clear, adult volunteers are mandated reporters along with paid employees. Okay. For volunteers, that just repeats the definition. But this includes those supervising staff or volunteers caring for children. So let's say you're the director of Christian Ed for a church that's big enough that you don't teach a class, you don't come in contact with a child, you oversee volunteers and you run programs and you write curriculum, but people report to you. You are also a mandated reporter if you are supervising staff or volunteers. If you're a volunteer who is supervising volunteers, you are a mandated reporter. So specifically included here are clergy people, spiritual leaders, right? That's pretty clear. In terms of clergy privilege, we get this question sometimes. According to the law, clergy privilege is defined very, very, very narrowly. And that is to say that there must be the expectation of a tradition that recognizes confessional absolution. Does that make sense? So the confines of clergy privilege would be in the confines of the confessional. Catholics in here? Is there any? Okay. Protestants generally, I would allow you to correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I don't know of a Protestant tradition that has that theological understanding of confession and absolution in that way. Yeah, you do. Okay. Okay, so there may be a small, narrow window there if the person has the expectation of confidentiality for that reason. Outside the confessional, then, that clergy person would be a mandated reporter. And the same is true for clinicians. Our office walls are supposed to be ironclad in terms of confidentiality, and we are obligated to report what is said to us in that confidential space. So I think pastors want to push that envelope further than the law would allow. Okay, so the clearances that are required for employees now, as of the law, or as of the change of the law at the end of the year, employees are required to get the Pennsylvania child abuse, the Pennsylvania criminal records check, and the FBI clearances. Those top two can be done online. The third one, you go online, you fill out a little piece, you print out a thing, you take it to the UPS store, and they give you fingerprints. Or else the state police. It's like two weird places you get FBI fingerprints. This went into effect December 31st of 2014 with a one-year transition period, which means that you need to have these done by January 31st of 2015. So they've given us a year to transition into that. For volunteers, the law requires the first two, the PA child abuse and the PA criminal records check. And if you have not been a resident of Pennsylvania for the last 10 years, you have to get the FBI checks. If you have been a resident of Pennsylvania for the last 10 years, you do not need the FBI fingerprints. For new volunteers, this becomes effective July 1st of 2015 with a one-year implementation date. So all clearances need to be in hand by July 1st of 2016. So they've given us a bit of leeway there on that one. Any questions? Yeah.
How frequently do you have to get these clearances?
So the law changed around that. The clearances are now required to be current every 36 months. So it used to be that how many school teachers or people working in the school system do we have? They had to be current up to a year upon the date of hire, and then you never had to get them again as long as you were in continuous service. That's no longer the case. They've given us a three-year window now, but they have to be done every 36 months, every 36 months. Yeah. Yes.
Can one clearance apply to both, or do you have to do more than one?
When you say both, what?
I was giving somebody a form, and she asked me for a second copy because of some work she's doing somewhere else.
So what the law says is that you can accept copies as long as you see the original. So it may be that you have to borrow the original from one employer to take it to the place you're volunteering, let them see it, make a photocopy, and then the photocopy is good. Yep. Yeah, but one set of clearances does work for volunteers in that way. Yeah. And that's what we would say. Somebody asked the question about cost. We've got limited resources, and how do we manage limited resources with all that there is to do? What I say is... many of your volunteers, I'd like to do a little informal research study someday to see just what this number is. 50% of your volunteers work in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts or Little League or volunteer at the kids' school. And because of that, everybody is requiring this. This is not just your church. And so when people kind of freak out and say, oh my gosh, it's going to be so expensive, my first thing is find out who has them already. I know a construction company that requires clearances of their employees. And that's not the law. That's just being careful. That's best practice. But people are getting these, and people have them. Yeah.
My husband's in construction. Every year, he has to get his renewed.
Okay.
Every single year in March, they send it and gets it renewed.
Yep. So, uh-huh. Oh, even before this.
Oh, for the last 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like they were ahead of even us in the field. Yeah. Yeah.
So you said this is effective for new volunteers. So if people, let's say that people got clearances last year or year before, do they go into that three-year track from the clearances that they already have? And they're not, they've been volunteering.
Did you? Yes. Okay.
Has to be some someone and a policy that says we need to regularly look at this and who is due. Yeah.
You know what? I think I said that wrong. I think I had my information wrong. Help me here, Carl. It seems to me that for volunteers that are already in your system, you don't need to have those up to date until July 1st of 2016. As of July 1st of 2015, any new volunteer walking in the door has to have their clearances. So I think I said that wrong. Once July 1st happens, everybody new has to live into the new policy, but they're going to give us a year to get everybody old caught up. So the 2016 is old volunteers. The 2015 is new volunteers.
So the very first day that someone volunteers to work with children, the office already has all this paperwork. They can't be like, oh, it's in process, or we turned it in last night, or something. They have to have the paperwork on copy.
Starting July 1st. So this is the kind of thing we'll talk about in the Safe Church program. And this is pretty detailed, but there is a specification in the law that gives a 90-day transition period. So but there's stipulations. If they have applied for the clearances and they're in process, if they have signed and affirmed that there's no disqualifier that would keep them from working with children, that these clearances are going to come back clear. If you do not ever leave them alone with children, but always put them in the same place with somebody who has their clearances, there may be one other thing, but you are allowed that transition period for no more than 90 days while someone's clearances are in process. Yeah. We would recommend, as part of your policy formation, that you create that document and then put it in your policy. When you work with us to develop the policy, if you go through the Safe Church program, we would provide you a sign and affirm document, kind of an appendix of those documents. But it is a sign and affirm statement. So I think it wouldn't be a hard document to come up with. I sign and affirm that I have not committed. And I don't think it's in this PowerPoint. But when the clearances come back, they now, according to the law, there is a list of legal disqualifiers so that churches are not permitted. You're not permitted to put someone in contact with a child if certain things show up on their clearances. And it would be our recommendation that on your sign and affirm statement that you have that list of disqualifiers. So you would make that list and you would say, I sign and affirm that I have not committed any of the following, and then the list that would disqualify me from working with children. Sign it. It doesn't have to be notarized. You might want to have a witness, but I don't think the legislation mandates how you go about that. Was there another question? No. Okay. Okay. If someone has been a resident of Pennsylvania for 10 years and does not need the FBI clearances, they must also sign and affirm. You need a sign and affirm statement for that as well, that simply says that they have not lived outside of Pennsylvania for 10 years, and they don't have any of that list of legal disqualifiers. Yeah.
I just want to say there's a document on, there's a website called keepkidssafepa.org.
Okay, I don't know.
The address wrong, but it's kind of in there somewhere, but I was looking on there, and this state has provided a form.
Okay.
And it lists all those disqualifiers, and it also says, I affirm that I've been a resident for 10 years.
Okay.
And it's on there because we were at our church trying to decide, are we going to make our own policy for this?
Yeah.
Or are we going to use a form? But there is a sample one on that keepkidssafepa.org site.
Excellent. That's great to know. Okay.
Because we were kind of in that conversation, like, how are you going to know if they're really been a resident for 10 years? Are we just...
Yeah. Yep. Okay, great. Thank you for that. Yeah, so this becomes the internal conversation, culture change, policy question, right? Because I just did this yesterday with a middle judicatory, and so they say, like, well, who keeps these clearances? Like, so that becomes the question. Well, wait a minute. We don't even have policies about who keeps the clearances, and then who's going to keep track of these clearances? And what happens, like, are they locked? Well, who has the key to that room, right? So you begin to, like, pull further and further away from this and realize all the things that we don't have good policies about how we manage that internally. So these are the questions. Because we see here that with these sign and affirm statements, you don't need the FBI checks done every 36 months, but you do need sign and affirm statements every 36 months. So who in your system is going to track this? Who's going to keep this? Who's going to get the clearances when they come in? This is confidential information. Who has access to this confidential information? What kind of guarantees of anonymity and privacy can you guarantee people when they entrust you with their clearances? If the church pays for the clearances come right back to the church. If the individual pays for the clearances come to the individual. So if the church pays for them and you end up with their information, which might even have things like social security number on it, or at least parts of social security numbers, what can you tell people about that? Those are questions that you need to be able to answer. Okay.
The website is just like she said, so it's .gov.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Okay, great. Okay, so this is a question that was asked and answered. They can submit copies, but the law says that you must see the original. Okay, so when somebody makes a report, when somebody finds out that there has been abuse, let me get on a soapbox for just a minute as a small caveat. What I've just told you, all that I just told you, is that all the people who are working in your camps and in your Sunday schools and in your churches and in wherever with children are now mandated by law to report child abuse. They can be fined and imprisoned for not reporting child abuse. There is no stipulation in the law that those people need trained on what it is they need to report. I think the law has created an incredibly large hole for people to fall into when they don't mandate training for the people who are mandated by law to report. So it is absolutely our recommendation that as systems, you think about how to give your people good information. Such as this kind of thing. When somebody makes a report to you, when a child makes a report to you, it is not your job to determine whether or not it's true, right? It is not your job to investigate. It's not your job to make any kind of assessment about what's happened. And that is, in addition to being a theological issue, in addition to being an issue of keeping kids safe, that too is a legal liability issue. Because if a child comes to you with a report, somebody touched me inappropriately. I have a neighbor who touched me inappropriately. And you ask enough questions to convince yourself, this kid has a tendency to lie. It's kind of a troubled home. I know that neighbor. That neighbor's a good person. I can't really believe that's true. I'm going to sit on this for a minute. You have investigated and made your own conclusion. And down the road, it's proven that it did happen. You didn't report that, and you should have. It is not reported if you think it's true. It's reported if there is reasonable cause to suspect or direct disclosure. So that's two different things. If there's direct disclosure, it might be the most outlandish thing that you've ever heard in your life. If somebody says, whatever a five-year-old's version of, I was inappropriately touched by my pastor, and that pastor is like a saint, that was a direct disclosure. You are mandated to report that. Or a kid has a lot of bruises or a lot of bumps or more broken arms than any third grader should ever get, and you've got reasonable cause to suspect, you're mandated to report that without investigation. You don't go to the mother and say, like, what happened? They seem to be getting a lot of broken arms. Can you explain that? No, reasonable cause. All you should do is get minimal facts. Yeah.
What does the law say about who you report to?
We'll get there. Yeah.
I just want to say, when you're talking, your emphasis has been on the sexual abuse, but there are all other categories of abuse that are included in the law, and that's where we're talking about the mandated reporter kind of training is essential, because it's just like mind-boggling to read that.
So it's our recommendation that right in your policy, you have the definition of child abuse. Our policy that we put together starts with a theology of safe church. So we invite you and insist that you, as a congregation, wrestle hard with the theological mandate of this. This is not just about the law. This is about our theological mandate to child protection. And what is that? So I know a person, or to safe church. I know a person who pastors a church that is right beside a sex offender treatment program. So their theology of safe church, their theology of safe sanctuary, is going to look really different than Christ Church at Grove Farms, that has a massive Sunday school and lots of kids running around. Their theology of child protection might be, we're going to turn kids away at the door because we serve as primarily a place of safety for the lepers, for the social lepers, and therefore cannot minister to children. Right? Like that, I don't know what their theology of safe church is. But that is a contextual question that every congregation needs to wrestle with. So that's one thing that we ask churches to do when we're putting these policies together. The second thing is include the definition of child abuse. I think there are five categories of child abuse, sexual abuse being one of them. Physical abuse, mental abuse, neglect, imminent risk. Yeah, right. So yes, there are many things that need to be reported. And I think the swing is wide. We were at one of these recently where somebody stood up and gave a kind of a rant about spanking. And if, like, I'm going to have my kids taken away if I spank them, right? And I suppose once or twice in history, somebody reported too much. We need to know, you know, the stipulations for abuse aren't reasonable discipline. On the other side, we need to know what we need to be reporting. So I think we can fall off the edges on both sides, which is what the education is about. Okay, if a volunteer or staff person in a caregiving capacity fails to act to protect a child, for example, does not report a reasonable suspicion or a disclosure of abuse, that person can now be investigated by Child Protective Services as a perpetrator, and if the report is substantiated, listed on the registry as a perpetrator. So failure to act is treated as if you were the actor. And I think I've started to see this in the news a bit more. And I think what shows up in the news, or at least what shows up in my psyche, is mothers with boyfriends where the mother doesn't stop it. That is not the only place this plays out. But when the mother knows that it's happening and doesn't stop it, the mother can be convicted, and the law says that they will be convicted as a perpetrator themselves. Childline. That's who you call. Childline is an 800 number that exists statewide. And so you don't need then to know the number for Allegheny County and Beaver County and Butler County and the Child Protective Services in each of your areas. You just need to know Childline. Childline will then funnel your report to the right county agency. So it's a once and done kind of call. Except to say that once you call, they'll tell you what else you have to do. And what else you have to do is, within 48 hours, submit a report that's a follow-up report. That's the document. It's C-747. Childline will let you know all of that when you call them. And it gives as much detailed information as you have and as they ask for. So So that's who you call. You call Childline. If you are a mandated reporter and you call Childline, you are mandated to give, I mean, you have to give your contact information so that there's a record that you made a report. The new law does protect anonymity, and so your anonymity is safe except in cases where it becomes adjudicated and you might be called to testify. They can compel you to testify, which would violate your anonymity. But otherwise, that your anonymity is safe when you make a report. So action steps. First, you must immediately report suspected abuse to Childline, orally or electronically. Then report to the person in charge, which is identified in your policy. So that's why, you know, another place that it's important to have good policies. It used to be, if you followed the Sandusky case at all, that mandated reporters reported up the chain, right? You report up to the supervisor who then makes the report. And if you recall, that was the ethical issue of Joe Paterno, because Joe Paterno followed the law. He reported up to his supervisors. His supervisors then did not make the report to Childline. And that's who's currently being prosecuted right now. But they realized that the law is really incomplete, because once the Sunday school teacher tells the director of Christian Ed, it's off their plate. They're off the hook, right? Now, the law says you must report out. So the Sunday school teacher reports out and then tells the supervisor, but must report out first. And this became effective at the end of December. So this is currently the law, has been the law. Okay. Any questions about anything I just said? Any? Yeah. No, it behind you.
I would like to be able to share this with my church. Would it be possible to have this emailed to me so that it then can go to the proper person and the rector, and that person can make a determination if in July they want to have some consultation on this new policy?
What? Let me come in here, because there's a... The program, and these slides come from the program, was developed in Lancaster, and they have been copywritten. So that prevents us from just sending them out willy-nilly. It's not our decision to do that. The materials themselves have been copywritten. The information is not copywritten. The information is obviously from the law. But what, and there's a number of sources you can get that at, what we're encouraging churches to consider doing is to, and I'll pass these around to both sides, is to think about participating in a program like Safe Church. And both Michelle and, get this slide up here, both of our centers, we're co-leading this. Both Michelle and I have been trained to be trainers of Safe Church. This is the contact information, the phone numbers, websites. And I'm biased. Let me self-disclose that, transparency and all that stuff first. But I'm really biased because this program is an excellent program. It was designed before all the legislative stuff went into effect in Pennsylvania. And what I like about it is it's designed to really help churches think about what it means to be a safe, accepting church. The intent is not to turn churches into Fort Knox and make it hard for people to worship or to bring kids. The intent is, if anything, to be welcoming. And how do you welcome families? And how do you welcome kids? So the intent of this is to look not just at clearances. Michelle said clearances are just
the very tip of the iceberg for the Safe Church program. And for sure, right now, they're front and center for churches. But there's a bigger context. How do we protect kids? How do we make it safe for people who have been abused to either start or continue the healing process? How do we think about situations proactively if someone comes to your church and says, I'm a perpetrator and I'm on Megan's list, but I really like this church and I want to join? How do you handle that? And if you wait till you have that person in front of you, then you have to almost kind of say, well, we've got to figure this out. And you're really then developing the policy around John Doe. If you are proactive and get the policies in advance, then when this John Doe perpetrator comes and says, I would like to worship here on Sunday morning, you pull out the policy and say, we would welcome you. We want you to be here. Because of the history, here are some regulations that you have to abide by if you're going to be part of our congregation. So it's a lot more than just making sure there's windows in every door and two adults and clearances and that kind of thing. It's really looking at what does it mean to be safe. So the intent is to build up safety within a congregation. It's for sure looking at Sunday school teachers, volunteers, employees, looking at clearances. But it also addresses what it means for the person in your congregation who's sitting there Sunday after Sunday and was abused 20, 30, 40 years ago and may never, ever have self-disclosed. Yes. Right. There is a lot to address. Absolutely. There are templates, and they're part of the Safe Church program. And again, they've been copywritten, so we can't hand them out. Churches that go through the Safe Church program have access to all the templates, the forms, the guidelines, that kind of thing. They're out there.
Yeah, there's lots of examples.
Yeah, you can Google the swear and affirm statements, and yeah, they're out there. This is a nice, neat package, though.
How much is the package?
The package is, let me tell you what it involves first. The package, and there is a cost to it, because there's an awful lot of our time in it. The package includes clusters, and what we're trying to do is to get clusters of at least 7 to 10 churches together. Each church would send a minimum of 2 people to each cluster meeting, and there are 7 cluster meetings during the 9-month period. There can be 6, there can be 10, there could be 15 people from your congregation that would be part of that group. But at least 2 have to come to each meeting. So there's enough attending the cluster meeting to take it back to the full group so that there can be discussions back there, because it's really in the church where the policies are developed, where the implementation's done. So there's 7 cluster meetings, and they tend to be about 3 hours long on Saturday mornings. And Michelle and I will be leading those. There are...
And at that cluster meetings, we... Each of the, isn't it 6? Not 7?
It is 6. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Each
6.
Each of the 6 times we'll take a section of the policy to have the clusters work on at that time. So we'll take the theology of Safe Church. We'll take the approved adult policy. We'll maybe take the building policies, the Megan's Law policies, and have the people really engage with that policy so that at the end of the 6 sessions, you have a policy that has been created has looked at every one of these issues.
Right.
So is the model that you're training, let's say 2 people from a congregation go to that, do they go into that sort of cold to get trained as to how to take it back to the larger group to develop the policy,
mm-hmm.
or
yeah.
is it kind of the other way around? You expect them to have done, or maybe both, some of the
Yeah, but I think it's not so much about training so that they can train others. Really, the methodology is this must be from the bottom up. Culture change happens from the bottom up. And what happens is we get pastors that come to this. Then they go back to their church and they say, oh my gosh, we need a policy. We've got all these things to answer. We don't know it. And people are like, then write a policy, right? Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is get enough critical mass in a congregation that they're owning the process and creating dialogue and creating buzz so that this thing is being built from inside. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's the cluster meetings. Each church that is part of the cluster gets two educational events when either Michelle or I would come and talk individually with those congregations about sex abuse, about policy, whatever the concerns are. So each congregation gets two individual educational sessions. There is an all-day retreat specifically designed for adults who at some point in their life experienced abuse, so they can meet with other adults and either begin or continue that healing experience.
And that would be adult survivors from all churches in the cluster.
All churches in the cluster, male, female, it's all, yes.
And it wouldn't have to be just the core group that comes. It's the entire congregation.
Right. And there's also a curriculum for K through 12 that goes along with the Safe Church program. So it's what's the bottom line here? Got away from that. So it is a lot of time on Michelle and I to do all that. The bottom line is for a church to participate, the fee is $950. And that can be paid one time, done and over with. If churches want to spread that out in three payments or 100 a month, we're willing to work with churches to make it accessible because the bottom line is we're really not making money on this. We're almost losing money on this. I don't want to think about that. But we really are invested, the two agencies, in really helping churches become safe, in helping people understand what the new law means, in helping children stay safe, in helping people heal and continue to be healed from abuse. So you have these flyers. Contact information is here. Contact information is here. What we would encourage you to do is to go back, talk with your pastors or talk with your CE directors, talk with the people in charge and say, this is something we want to know about. And if you have questions or your leaders have questions, contact either Michelle or I, and we'll be glad to talk with you about this program or any questions you have, because that's our job. We want to make churches safe.
I would just say that I have colleagues in Central Pennsylvania who had congregations participate in the Safe Church program out of Lancaster, and they just raved about, they such high recommendations about how meaningful it was and important and truly helpful. So,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for saying
and
that.
She was not paid. Thank you. It really is an excellent program.
I didn't know what
program.
They were really talking about, but now I'm getting it.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yes.
I do think that we all need policies, but is that mandated in the new law?
No.
But if you don't have them, the church will be liable for not, let me say it a different way. The policies make it much less likely that the church would be thrown into any kind of suit because you have a clear policy. This is what we do in this situation. This is how we handle it. So you have your bases covered proactively.
But let me give the caveat that what makes you less safe is to get a policy on the books that you then don't follow.
Yes.
And I think that's part of the reason we are not inclined to give out templates, because there's such a temptation to want to get a policy in place that a pastor will write one. And I get a call maybe every 2 months from a pastor freaking out because a Megan's Law offender has showed up at church and now they don't know what to do. My first question is always, do you have a policy? And their answer is always, I think so, somewhere. Right? So to make a policy quick that you don't follow.
And the way Linda developed this, at the end of the 9 months, you really have a congregational committee who's been trained in this, who understands it, who has written the policy, and they can become the committee that really monitors this, implements it, brings it out year after year and says, what do we have to do to look at it this year? Who needs clearances this year? You have, it's not on the pastor or the church secretary to do it. There's a committee of people really committed to this. Yes?
I really commend you for persevering in this because I think, in my way of thinking, this should be a standard.
It should
based
be.
On
it
the
should
reality
be. Yes.
of our world and our society
yes.
is so prevalent and is such an issue. Like, you know, the woman that was offended because she was in the church, whatever, you know. It's like me loving children and forgetting for a moment what our world is really like
yeah.
and approaching a child in a grocery store and making them laugh and seeing the eyes roll on a first parent.
Yeah.
They don't know who I am.
Right.
And
right.
isn't that so sad?
Yes.
But it is the reality.
It's the world,
and
yeah, unfortunately.
It seems to me like it should be.
Yeah.
Not just in churches, all over the place. Anytime there's a connection with groups of people. So I'm very glad I came to this. This is very good.
Well, good.
Now, once the fee is paid for this and participants from the church attend all of your events, are you still available to them if they have questions?
Mm-hmm.
They could
yes. Yes.
And contact
yes.
one of you about
right.
things that they're still not clear on or whatever.
And we're available now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying about how we're really making the circuit, like it's a lot of middle judicatories that are saying our pastors need to hear this. So they have us come in for 3 hours and do this only longer to get some basic information into people's hands. So we're willing to be resources now. And we both have tables upstairs, so you can come
mm-hmm.
talk to us faster.
Dana.
The clusters, do you have any idea where they would meet? Is it Allegheny County?
We're waiting to see which churches sign up,
okay.
and we'll try to make them as geographically accessible as possible. And so that's the other intent is, too, that it not just if Christ Church grew, if this church would sign up, not every meeting would be here. That the intent is to rotate among the churches who sign up so that congregations get to know each other, what your building's like, this is what where we struggle with ours, and really build up a fellowship of churches within the Safe Church program. One last question. Pop it.
Yeah,
small churches in rural communities, they know. They know who in their communities is a sex offender. And that's where it happens because somebody is in prison for this, gets released from prison. Everybody in the community knows. Now they show up at worship. All the parents start taking their kids out of preschool because they're afraid, because we don't have good policies in place. Right? So sometimes you don't know, which means you need a good policy so that your kids are protected. And sometimes you do know, which means
means you need a good policy.
Right.
Either way, you need a good policy.
You can search online to find out.
Yeah, Megan's blog. Megan's blog.
Right. Yeah, we need to
cut
it. Michelle and I will be around the day and check out our
break.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Love you.